Okay, the next speaker is Ron Lorry. Ron is the Managing Director of Inflexion Point Strategy. Inflexion is a company, they're a set of advisors that help companies in acquiring, divesting, investing in IP-rich companies, and Ron will take it from there. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, the advantage of taking the late afternoon time slot on the second day is you can say something really stupid and only a few people will know about it. So the subject is patents in the boardroom. This is a personal perspective based on the fact that for the last couple of years I've been a director in a publicly traded company and have gotten involved, among other things, with SVDX, which is the Silicon Valley Directors Exchange, where I have talked to a lot of other corporate directors, and so this is anecdotal evidence and conclusions based on that interaction. So this is just my own personal perspective. My observation is that very few public company boards feel comfortable dealing with issues involving patent risk and value. And if they don't feel comfortable, they won't do it. One might ask, why? My answer is, at least the primary reason is that, generally speaking, corporate directors and patent on the one hand and patent professionals on the other, whether the patent professionals are in-house corporate IP managers or external advisors, such as lawyers and consultants, those two groups do not speak the same language. And as a result, they can't communicate very well with one another. And this is a major problem. Specifically, boards and investors, capital markets, lenders, and other financial professionals are focused on, almost exclusively, on financial performance metrics, such as near-term metrics, P&L, EBITDA, free cash flow. As you'll see, these are all not directly related to patents, but only indirectly, and that's the problem. Market share, share price and market cap. There have been entities that have tried to relate share price and market cap to the quality of the patent portfolio with varying success. Longer term, year-over-year performance, balance sheet, this is going to become a critical element of my talk, book value versus market value, debt to earnings ratio, and enterprise value, as in the case of acquisition value in an M&A context. So this is what CEOs, CFOs, and directors care about, because this is what affects them directly. On the other hand, patent professionals are usually focused on, as you well know, portfolio attributes like size, quality, and coverage. And here's just a laundry list of the things that they care about. Portfolio size. The traditional corporate patent department performance metric is size. Size matters historically. And this has produced the so-called 5% rule of thumb, which is that in any major corporate patent portfolio, 5% or less of the patents have any value other than zero, because patent departments are evaluated and rewarded based on quantity, not quality. Of course, that's changed over the last 10 years or so, but it's still a pretty good rule. Some companies have gotten up as high as 15%, according to people who have studied this, but that's about it. And part of the reason is that when you file the application, you're not sure whether the product is going to be successful or not. So you just hedge your bets and file. Claim scope, a very big deal. You want to be broad, but as Mark Lemley is wont to point out, not overbroad. You've got indefiniteness issues after Nautilus. You've got functional claiming problems. especially with means plus function claims and 112F. Disclosure support, more 112 issues, enablement, written description, and supporting structure, equivalent structure in the disclosure. Ability to withstand validity challenges. This is, of course, one of the most important things, especially after Alice. And the traditional validity challenges based on 102 and 103. Ease of detecting competitor infringement, especially in areas where reverse engineering is laborious and therefore expensive. Minimizing design around opportunities. You want to have the claim as broad as possible to prevent efficient design arounds as opposed to non-efficient design arounds. Defensive use. There's been a lot of discussion about acquiring patents through internal development or through external acquisition for their use in cross-licensing. In litigation avoidance, in the sense that I know of companies that acquire that are anticipating a competitor coming after them, which has a very strong patent portfolio, and so what they do is they acquire significant patents in terms of quality in the same area, and they publicize it so that there's a deterrent effect. And of course, settling litigations. One of the areas of high activity in the brokerage business is companies who acquire patents in order to settle out of litigation. That's what we call the pain point analysis. So these are the things that patent attorneys are used to thinking about. Now, how do you solve the mismatch between the things that are important to boards and senior management and the things that are important to patent lawyers? Well, you've got to establish a common language. And my belief is that the way to do that is to have the patent professionals learn the language of the board rather than the other way around, because the board is not going to learn patent language. Okay. So here's a kind of a chart. Oh, by the way, if you have any questions, just raise your hand and we'll do them in real time. This is a chart which obviously I don't have time to go through, but it compares the various kinds of patent risk with the various kinds of patent value. I can tell you that boards are much more sensitive to patent risk issues historically than they are to patent value. One of the reasons is because, in my opinion, no one really knows how to accurately measure patent value anyway. So the old adage that you can't manage what you can't measure really applies here. So here's some example situations. On the risk side, you have infringement exposure. Injunction risk is down, thanks to eBay. My own personal belief is that the primary effect of eBay was to seriously erode or eliminate any motivation for an accused infringer to take a license, because the downside risk is really just attorney's fees. Because if you lose the case, you'll pay what you would have paid in the beginning, assuming reasonable royalty is the measure. But there's a chance that you'll win the case, in which case you pay nothing. So why would anybody write a big check to someone who comes to them for a license? The result is companies in the licensing business are necessarily in the litigation business. Enter the whole NPE troll debate. Reasonable royalties, again, the risk is down thanks to apportionment. Enhanced damages, we talked about Halo yesterday, they're up. And attorney's fees are up for Octane. So you have sort of countervailing influences, some of which represent increased exposure, some of which represent reduced exposure. Something called impairment. Impairment is a financial accounting term as embodied in Financial Accounting Standard 142, which says that any acquired intellectual property assets that have lost value over the accounting period, that loss has to be reported. So what are the sources of impairment? Obviously, invalidity in the courts, which has been around for a long time, and now the PTAB potential for impairment of assets. Technical obsolescence, that's always, there's nothing new about that. You may have very broad patents that cover the best way of doing something today, but tomorrow somebody will invent a completely different way and your patents are no longer worth anything. Design around, again, the scope issue. How easy is it for competitors to design around and still have an efficient product, a competitive product from a market standpoint? That's an important element of design around. It's not just can you design a product that works without infringing the claim, it's can you design a product that anyone will buy that doesn't infringe the claim. And then there's an area that is came up yesterday in the Halo discussion. I asked a question about whether the failure to do patent searches could ever generate a shareholder suit. And the answer from the panel was business judgment rule, no problem, safe harbor. Certainly historically that's true. As IP becomes more important as an asset class, I think there may be some erosion of the business judgment rule, which really puts companies at more risk than they think they have, and I'll talk about one in a minute. You have traditional shareholder derivative suit liability, and now after Sarbanes-Oxley, you have personal liability on the part of directors and senior officers. So what are the sources of this mismanagement claim? Failure to settle third-party infringement claims. The first time I started noticing this was in the NTP RIM / BlackBerry case, where RIM could have settled the case for $25 million. There was a settlement offer on the table early on. They refused, and they ended up paying $613 million. I thought if anything was going to generate a shareholder suit, that would do it, but it didn't. On the other hand, Carnegie Mellon versus Marvell generated several shareholder suits, and so this whole idea of IP mismanagement, as IP becomes more and more important and a bigger share of the total asset base for any technology company, I think we're going to see probably some erosion of the business judgment rule. One of those areas that has already been eroded is the so-called Revlon rule, that says in an M&A context, it's fiduciary duty of senior management and directors to maximize the return to shareholders in any M&A deal. There's no business judgment safe harbor. So for example, if you're the acquirer and especially in the age of activist shareholders, which everybody worries about at these board conferences, if you're the acquirer, you're subject to a suit for overpaying because that's mismanagement of your IP assets. Conversely, if you're the acquired company, the target, you may get a suit for under-receiving. So keep an eye on the mismanagement, the IP mismanagement area. On the value side, there are a number of contexts in which value can be realized. One is strategic value. Strategic value tends to produce the highest numbers. That's the company-to-company competitor lawsuit situation, where there is the possibility, although I think largely theoretical now, of obtaining an injunction. And again, this is a high tech. Life sciences is a different area. I've seen statistics on how many injunctions have been issued, although they're somewhat dated, and there are many more injunctions issued in life science, and I think the reason for that is that those are consent decrees where there's an agreed settlement with an injunction as part of it. Then there's the more realistic value driver, which is taxation of your competition via license fees. Or if they decide to take the design around approach via increased cost of goods sold. So you're giving yourself competitive advantage in the marketplace and hopefully increased market share by raising the cost of doing business for your competitors. There's the more traditional, conventional approach of generating top line revenue through licensing and more recently through sale. There is something that doesn't get enough attention. I think that there's more value being transferred in this area than in the top line case, and that is using IP and patents in particular in support of corporate transactions like joint ventures and spin-outs and increasing acquisition price in an M&A context. This is the area where I spend most of my time. And then there's portfolio effects, which says as the size of the portfolio grows, you get a hedging effect such that the likelihood that that all of the patents that are asserted or the subject of a transaction will be invalidated goes down as the number increases. That's just probability theory. The next two elements are really interesting because this is part of how you get around the problem. Every company has a different materiality threshold as to what gets to the board or should get to the board in terms of patent risk and value issues, depending on the industry for sure, on the maturity of the company, on the size of the company. And so this is really not the place where you want to apply one size fits all rules. And the problem is, how do you create a materiality filter such that any company can look at their own attribute list and decide how important it is and therefore what things ought to get to the board and what things should not get to the board that are sort of ordinary course management decisions. So materiality is certainly important. Measurability, this is materiality can be solved, and I'll say a little bit more about one effort that's going on now to sort of codify a methodology for determining materiality for any company so that they know what should get to the board and what shouldn't. But the other one is much tougher to deal with, and that's measurability, both of risk and value. Litigation risk has been the subject of analysis, quantitative analysis using decision tree logic and other forms of analysis. And there are companies that specialize in doing litigation risk, where you predict the various outcomes that could happen and attach probabilities to each of them, and somehow get a sense of what the overall risk is. That's what I call the easy part. It also gets very difficult in some situations. The value side, on the other hand, is always difficult because of the valuation problem. My own sort of example of the valuation problem is that in terms of asset value, patents are a lot like commodities and particularly futures. The value of an orange juice future on what the price of oranges will be next year is to a large extent out of your control. It depends on what the weather is in Florida and California and a lot of things that are absolutely out of your control, just like the value of a software patent turned out to be out of your control because of changes in the legal environment. So instead of the weather, you've got to deal with the Supreme Court. And so that's why it's often extremely difficult. Here's the accounting problem, and this is really critical. Because all of those financial metrics, they come out of the accounting system. They come out of GAAP and ITRS and a lot of other standards. The problem is the accounting profession does not know how to value intangible assets, particularly in the case of patents on next generation technologies. Why is that? That's because accounting predicts future performance based on past performance. And when you're talking about next generation technologies, there is no past performance to use as a guide. The value, for example, the value of brands, let's say, tends to be a current valuation topic. In other words, what the brand is worth is measured by what it's worth right now, not necessarily tomorrow. But what a patent portfolio on next generation technology is worth will only be known as the future unfolds. And so how do you deal with that uncertainty? And that's a problem that has been identified by a lot of very smart economists, such as Professor Baruch Lev at the NYU Stern School, who just wrote a book that if you're interested in this topic, you should definitely read, called The End of Accounting, where he says that the accounting profession are the wrong people to try and value intangible assets. And the best example of that is that there is currently no way to get internally generated IP, as opposed to externally acquired IP, onto the balance sheet. And the balance sheet is one of the most important measures of corporate financial performance from the standpoint of investors. And so there's a huge mismatch between current practice in reporting value and what you can do on the patent side. What's coming? There's a standardization effort that's just been launched by Licensing Executive Society. They have five committees on creating IP standards around different things, such as brokerage and licensing. One of them is called IP in the Boardroom, and there are three of us here who are on that committee. It's very challenging to try and develop standards around IP consideration in the boardroom. The area that seems to be getting the most attention is trade secrets, and particularly hacking, theft of trade secrets via the internet. There's very little work that's been done on the patent side. There's more work that's been done on the brand side. And so LES is working on that. And the other recent development is the SEC has posted a request for comments on increasing the disclosure requirements, public company disclosure requirements, in a number of areas, including IP, and LES has submitted a position paper on that issue. The problem with disclosure is that no company wants to disclose their IP strategy, and the more information they disclose, the easier it is for competitors to figure out what their strategy is. So you have a real built-in reluctance to disclose too much about IP. So that's the overview. Any questions? Julie?
The first question I have on this chart is, what do you think the problem is? Why is this happening, this gap in appreciation? And then the second thing is, who do you think should be the messenger to the board so that they can be educated about this issue?
Okay. First, I think it's a historical effect that even though most people know that that the major source of corporate value comes from intangible assets, estimates are 70 to 80%, we're still, the rules that the accounting profession has imposed on companies are rooted in an area when intangible assets were not worth anything. And in terms of who does it, well, somebody, this is one argument in favor of having a CIPO, because if you have an O at the end of your name, you're more likely to get the attention of top management, including the other titles that end in O, like the CFO and the CEO. And if you get there, then you're more likely to get to the board. And I think the education function is critical. The IP professionals have to educate the senior management and the board on the value and the risk of IP-related things. But the essence of my talk is they have to do it in language that the board understands. And if they try and explain it in terms of patent validity and PTAB, they've lost the battle. Robert?
On that, I don't understand. Are you saying, on your point about talking the board's language, that the underlying terms are the board language? Or how does this chart illustrate talking to the board in their language?
Well, it still
looks like our language to me.
this is your language.
Okay.
But the board doesn't relate to these terms. The board right. doesn't mean anything to the board. They have to be translated into the financial metrics that were in the first slide. You have to express how this affects market share, how it affects free cash flow, because that's the only thing they're going to pay attention to.
Okay. One more question while I have the mic. At the very end, you said companies don't want to disclose their IP strategy for obvious reasons. But why is that different from business strategy? Why are they more reluctant to, and maybe you're implying more justified in keeping their IP strategy away from SEC requirements than business strategy in general?
Yeah, I think because business strategy is an area where no one expects them to disclose too much. But investors, the investor position is that they have a very strong interest in understanding how much the IP contributes to the corporate value and to the risk profile of the company. And I think it's time for the next panel, so I apologize for cutting off the questions. Thanks.